Blog Talk Radio.
This week's show is sponsored by Audible, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
Y'all ready for this?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week of politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. Our show this week is concentrated around two topics. First, the scandal engulfing New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and his administration. The Rude Pundit joins me to discuss what has transpired so far and where this scandal seems to be going. Then, internationally recognized columnist and political analyst Rachel Marsden joins me to give her perspective on the Edward Snowden saga. At the end, we will have the return of our trademark weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. If you want to write to me and give me your opinion of any topic I cover, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. And I may just read your opinion on the air. Again, that's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. So let's jump right into the discussion about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. To help me discuss Chris Christie, I have Lee Papa here with me. And Lee is an associate professor of English at City University of New York Staten Island campus. Lee is one of the most widely read progressive bloggers under his alter ego, The Rude Pundit, at rudepundit.blogspot.com. He's the author of several books, including The Rude Pundit's Almanac, and is a frequent guest on the Stephanie Miller radio show. And, of course, frequent listeners will remember that he is a frequent guest here as well at Making Sense. So welcome back to the show, Lee.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Always great to have you. Now, as a reminder for everyone, what we're going to be talking about today, this guy, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, his staff literally closed down three lanes of traffic on one of the busiest bridges in the world for 4 days to punish what they considered to be one of his political opponents, the mayor of Fort Lee. Now, those are facts that are not in dispute, okay? That is not a partisan charge. There are emails. The governor acknowledges that this is what happened. He has fired someone over it. And two other of his staffers have resigned, one of whom is facing questions from the New Jersey State Legislature and is taking the Fifth Amendment rather than answering those questions. Those are the facts so far, right, Lee?
Yeah, the only thing that I'll say is that I believe it was they closed two of three lanes of traffic and that went from Fort Lee to the George Washington Bridge. And right now everybody's just presuming that he was angry at the mayor of Fort Lee because of the lack of endorsement. But so far there's nothing in the emails that seem to confirm why they were targeting, you know, as they called him, that idiot and that little Serbian, even though he's Croatian. But apparently, you know, those nuances don't really matter when you're dealing in thuggish, you know, behavior.
You know, we're supposed to believe, here's the part that I love. We're supposed to believe that he, the governor, Chris Christie, the guy ultimately in charge of everything that happens in New Jersey, as far as state government is concerned, that he knew nothing about the cause of the lane closings from August until a few days ago, when there were half a dozen people to a dozen people who could have given him the answer if he had pressed them. You can't tell me that everyone stonewalled the governor of the state when asked why this happened. Do you believe that?
No, that's why all of the politicians that have dealt with Christie here that have no reason to cover his ass, like Richard Cody, who's the state senator who was governor for a year and actually was quite a good governor, a Democrat. He told Salon that I don't even think it's a paraphrase to say he called bull and said no, there's no way he didn't know. So there must be something going on in the way that he's nuancing some of these things. I mean, Christie's also a lawyer. And, you know, I was watching that press conference thinking, all right, is he doing the Clinton, you know, trying, depends on the definition of is kind of wiggle room.
Well, you know, I was on Fox News, Fox Business's The Independents Thursday night, and I said, this is Chris Christie's, it depends on what the meaning of bridge is speech, you know, I mean, because I was like you, I was wondering, how is he going to get around this, because he's obviously lying, right? I mean, how can he get out of this? And, you know, now there's an FBI investigation, there are federal prosecutors that are going to be involved, and if he lied, and I think he did, I think he's really screwed. But I want to press on from that. There, after all this stuff started to come out, he has this pity party of a press conference that he holds on Thursday, right, where he asserts he didn't know and poor him and all of that. And the funny thing is, I have Republican friends, some of whom were criticizing him before that press conference, that are now saying how wonderful it is that he took responsibility, how unlike some other folks. I think they mentioned Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But you know what? He didn't take responsibility, did he, Lee? I mean, just because at one point...
Not. Absolutely
no.
not.
No, that just, was... no, just because at one point in the 107-minute farce, he says that I take responsibility, that doesn't count if for the rest of the 107 minutes you're blaming other people, particularly Bridget Kelly, right?
Right. Well, first of all, he said I in the press conference. I think somebody counted it like several hundred times. And, you know, the only reason that anybody should give a damn about that is because... people have done that to Barack Obama too. So, but yeah, I mean, he spent more time talking about his betrayal and, you know, this deep betrayal. I mean, really, it was like watching, you know, some caricature of a mob boss just sitting there and going, you know, Fredo, you know, you let me down or something like that. It was just. That was the crime. The crime was that he was betrayed. And you know, he even said the reason he fired Bridget Kelly, who was the deputy chief of staff, is because she lied to him. He didn't care why. She lied. So, and that was it. It was the betrayal of him, not the actions, not the things that they did to the people of Fort Lee, and you know, people from probably many places during those 4 days that those lanes were closed, causing the hours-long backup on the George Washington Bridge.
You know, and I went over the transcript today because something struck me last night as I was thinking about this. In 107 minutes... all of the things that he said, there's one paragraph with about three or four sentences where he apologizes to the people of Fort Lee that were the ones really affected by this for 4 days. One paragraph. The rest was poor him. Poor Chris Christie. And not only that, but this ridiculousness where he claims that he's not a bully. That was, I stood up from my chair when he said that, and I said some things that I can't repeat on the air to the screen, to the image of Chris Christie. You know what? I want to play a couple of things, and I want to get your opinion on them. Folks, here are some audio clips from video that Chris Christie's own staff shot and placed on YouTube. Here you go.
Did I say on topic? Are you stupid? On topic. Next question.
Yet you have numbnuts like Reed Gashura. Get the hell off the beach.
Hey, Gail, you know what? First off, it's none of your business. I don't ask you where you send your kids to school. Don't bother me about where I send mine.
Thank you all very much, and I'm sorry for the idiot over there.
You know what? It's people who raise their voices and yell and scream like you that are dividing this country.
A heated exchange captured on camera between New Jersey's Governor Chris Christie and a former Navy SEAL. What led to it all? Here's ABC's Mark Greenblatt.
Please consider veteran students and non-traditional students like myself here.
At this town hall meeting, Rutgers law student Bill Brown admits he did interrupt New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, but never expected this.
If you decide what you want to do is put on a show today, let me tell you something. I can go back and forth with you as much as you want.
Brown says he and thousands of others who signed this online petition haven't been able to get Chris Christie to hear their concerns about the governor's plan to merge two New Jersey colleges. But when Brown decided to go straight to Christie himself and wouldn't back down, he got an earful.
And let me tell you something. After you graduate from law school, you conduct yourself like that in the courtroom, your rear end's going to get thrown in jail, idiot.
And it's not the first time Chris Christie has made headlines for his combative style, taking on teachers' unions and even his own constituents.
What you want to do is put on a show and giggle every time I talk? Well, then I have no interest in answering your question.
But this time...
I'm a Navy SEAL. I honorably served this country. I'm a law school student. I didn't deserve to be called an idiot.
He may have met his match in an ex-Navy SEAL.
One of those clips was from CNN's Crossfire, and the other one was from ABC News here in New York. Okay, so Lee, what do you think of those clips versus Christie's statement that he's not a bully?
Well, as the New York Times reported, he actually has people who follow him around with a camera waiting for those moments so that they can put them up on YouTube and, you know, cause a sensation. In fact, if you go to, and this is really hilarious, if you go to the Chris Christie YouTube channel, there the titles of the videos, and this is something I just found this morning, Steve, so this is just f-ing hilarious. It's the titles of these videos are Chris Christie calls reporters stupid for asking an off-topic question. Chris Christie owns hecklers in New Hampshire. Chris Christie gets into a shouting match with an idiot. Chris Christie destroys reporter on his praise for Obama. I mean, come on. This is childish. This is playground bullshit. And this is what they want them to have, this image of him as, you know, he takes no crap and, you know, he'll throw it right back at you. What's interesting about the clips that you showed is that he uses the same line over and over. I think twice he says, if you want to make this a show. And it's like, but dude, you have a YouTube channel that's the Chris Christie f***ing with people channel.
The Chris Christie bullying people. That is his carefully cultivated persona. That's who they want to be projected about Chris Christie. That's who he is. And now for him to come and say, I'm not a bully. Poor me. Feel sad for me. Come on. That's who you are.
Right. And he should have owned that. You know, if nothing else, I mean, he at one point said he was going to get all self-reflective about what he has done in order for his staff to think they could do that. Oh, f*** you, man. He is, here's what I think happened, and I wrote about it this week. I think that he was sitting in his office, and he was pissed off about that they tried for 200 Democratic endorsements for governor. And he was pissed off at Sokolich, the mayor of, and I don't think I'm pronouncing that right, but sorry, pissed off at the mayor of Fort Lee. Now, my theory, everybody's throwing theories around as to why they did this. My theory is, I think he felt the mayor of Fort Lee owed him. I think he felt the mayor of Fort Lee owed him because of the cancellation of the Trans-Hudson Tunnel that would have taken a ton of traffic away from the George Washington Bridge. This was going to be a new rail commuter rail tunnel that was going to be mostly paid for, like something like 90% paid for by the federal government. That Christie, in one of the first things he did in office, canceled this tunnel from Secaucus, New Jersey, to New York City. And if you take traffic away from Fort Lee, you take traffic tickets away from Fort Lee. You take traffic going to businesses in Fort Lee away. And I think he felt the mayor owed him. And he may not, and just the most generous interpretation possible, is he may not have said, let's cause a traffic problem, but I think he did say, somebody ought to get that son of a b-.
Reminds me of, will somebody rid me of this meddlesome priest from Thomas Becket. I think you're probably right. I don't know if the exact reasoning for why he did it was right, but I think that's probably something along the lines of what his direction was to his staff. I mean, I can't get over this insane notion that his staff did this without him. This is a guy, I mean, just listening to the things that he says to people, this is a guy who has his orders obeyed or else, right? The idea that political operatives like Bill Baroni and David Wildstein and Bridget Kelly went around his back to do something is impossible to believe, right? And the other thing a lot of people aren't talking about, his spokesperson, Druniak, it turns out that guy was in the email chain, and that guy is on top of everything. If somebody made the remark that if somebody in New Jersey burps and it sounds even vaguely anti-Christie, This guy is all over it with some snarky remarks that he says come straight from the governor's office. So zero chance that Christie didn't know, zero chance in 4 or 5 months that he didn't find out and didn't know about this at least at some point. And the guys that I was on with Thursday night on the Independence, I think it was Matt Welch, who said the best thing that this guy can say is he's completely incompetent at hiring people and putting them around him, right? I mean, what if this guy's president and the people that he puts around himself are just like these, because that's who he seems to attract and hire, these vindictive people? What if they're Secretary of Defense? What if they're Director of National Intelligence, and they decide to use those powers to get at his political enemies? I mean, it's really scary. I think you and I would have to go into hiding, Lee.
Right. I mean, it would be surrounding himself with a bunch of J. Edgar Hoovers and just to go after enemies. You know, there's an interesting talking about, you know, how much in advance they knew about this. That quick email exchange between, you know, the Port Authority official David Wildstein and Bridget Ann Kelly, where Kelly says to Wildstein, "Time for some traffic problems in Fort Lee," and Wildstein says, "Got it." Now, that means there was a plan, like we're pulling the trigger on a plan that we set up a while back. And so that means that when was this plan first put into place? Do they have plans on how to punish lots of people, and, you know, they just need the word to pull the trigger?
That's a good point.
There's not any
instruction in there. They had to have had some kind of plan in place. I think you're exactly right. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, so they knew. They knew that at this point. Now, you know, I also think that it's also worth looking into to see what Wildstein might have had against the mayor of Fort Lee or against Fort Lee. Because, you know, first there's Wildstein taking the fifth, and just a side note here, Wildstein's a creepy looking motherfucker. If that guy doesn't have kiddie porn and a torture chamber at his house, I would be shocked. But seriously, look at him, and you go, holy crap, I don't want to be around that guy. And he went out and personally looked at the traffic. I mean, just think about that. He went out there to see it. He was getting off on this. And that's in the new batch of emails that have come out. And he's the one that said, you know, that he doesn't care about the children because they're Buono voters.
Wow. Yeah.
This is a vindictive, and this is a crony. He was a political blogger. He was a New Jersey political blogger who had been anonymous for a while, big Christie supporter, and then after Christie was reelected, they gave him this made-up position that paid him a ton of money. You know, I've heard anything from $150,000 to $200,000 a year with no experience in transportation. So I don't know what the hell is going on there, but I'm with all the people that are saying, you know, this has a Watergate feel to it. We're just at the break-in part.
And that's kind of what I wanted to ask you next. I'm starting to see, for instance, some unconfirmed reports so far, but that Alan Zega, some of the statements that he made on behalf of his client, David Weinstein, in the legislative hearing, suggests that he is soliciting some immunity offers for his client in order for his client to testify. I want to know what you think is going to happen here. What's going to be the end result? The FBI is investigating. There's signs a federal prosecutor may get involved. What is going to be the end result of this? Is Christie going to go down for this? Does he have any chance in 2016 at all, by the way?
No, 2016's over. I mean, you know, all you need, just imagine a Rand Paul ad that has school children school children on a bus, trapped on a bus on a summer day, waiting to get to their first day of school. You have a commercial of a bus full of kindergartners. They haven't even investigated what crimes were committed while police were busy trying to take care of traffic in Fort Lee. That was another diversion of force.
Good point.
Yeah. And so there's all of this stuff that still has to come out. I really think we're at that tip of the iceberg where Wildstein, you know, is a wild card. God, that's terrible. I hate that I just said that. And but you know, Christie threw him under the bus, but just made him seem like the nerdiest son of a bitch that, you know, like that pimply faced guy that used to hang around the popular Chris Christie, you know, class president athlete Chris Christie. And, you know, he says that, you know, I barely knew the guy. Well, you barely knew the guy, but you gave him a high-profile job. That
yeah.
He maybe was somebody that worshipped you in high school and kept worshipping you. So Wildstein, I think, might go for some kind of deal. And I think that as far as 2016 goes, Christie was in trouble for lots of reasons. I mean, one of the things that I pointed to, you know, teabaggers were already suspicious of him, but when they start looking at things, you know, when Ted Cruz puts out an ad talking about Chris Christie's threat to use eminent domain to take land from people on the Jersey Shore in order to build up the dunes there, something which I support. I think that that's a great use of eminent domain, but that flips teabaggers the hell out.
Well, I think if nothing else, you and I can have a side business. If Christie does try to run for the Republican nomination, we could have a side business, you and I, creating ads for Rand Paul and Marco Rubio.
Wouldn't that be hilarious?
Yeah. But
right. And you know, I hope Hillary Clinton just sort of shredded the Christie file and said, "All right, let's move on to Scott Walker."
Oh my God, you just gave me nightmares there. Scott Walker is president. But as far as Christie is concerned, do you think he ends up resigning? Do you think he ends up prosecuted for this?
Wow. I think it, you know what's going to be the test? The test is going to be if Fox News turns on him. And that sounds weird, but he's Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch's chosen candidate. You know,
that
he has a... Oh, yeah, he has a relationship with Ailes, and he has a relationship with Murdoch. And I think that what's going to be the bellwether is if Fox News finally turns on him. If that happens, he's toast. But otherwise, he's got this public cover. I mean, Fox News, all they've talked about is, well, you know, this is just a distraction from Robert Gates' book about, you know, about Obama and Obama's defense decisions, or, you know, or, gee, why aren't we talking about Benghazi more? This is just a distraction from that. This reporters didn't dig this much into Benghazi. That's the Fox News line now. If that changes, Christie is gone.
Interesting. Now, my take on this is that he will end up resigning, and I think he will be facing federal charges. That's what I think is going to happen. I think at least one of these slimy individuals, Weinstein, Kelly, the other person who resigned, I think one of these folks is going to turn on him and is going to testify on him under threat of themselves going to prison for a significant amount of time.
I think it's very likely. And that's what I mean. Is that's the moment when something comes out that is more ironclad. I mean, Fox will have to turn on him. But if you want some crazy ass prediction here, it's that in lieu of prosecution, he resigns.
I agree. All right, we're out of time. He's one of the most widely read progressive bloggers in the country, Lee Papa, the Rude Pundit, with a blog at rudepundit.blogspot.com. Thank you for spending time with me again today, Lee.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want with Audible. Listeners of Making Sense with Steve Laser can get a free audiobook and 30-day trial membership if they sign up at www.audibletrial.com/lasersense. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles and virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. For instance, Inferno, the latest novel by Dan Brown, is available, as is The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith. Sign up now at www.audibletrial.com/lasersense.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. at scentreprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentreprises.com. Scentreprises, our business makes you sensational.
Zero Juliet uploaded.
I'd like to welcome Rachel Marsden to the show. Rachel is the CEO of Rachel Marsden Associates, a global strategic communications and political advisory firm. She's an international political and communication strategist, syndicated columnist, geopolitical analyst, writer, and journalist based in Paris, France, where she also teaches at the Paris Institute of Political Studies. She's appeared in varying capacities on Fox News, CNN, CNBC, RT, Al Jazeera, and a host of additional international television and radio networks. She's an internationally syndicated columnist with Tribune Media Services and a contributor to Human Events, Townhall.com, The Wall Street Journal, Spectator Magazine, and other publications. And in addition to that impressive resume, she's also a good friend. So welcome to the show, Rachel.
Thanks, Steve. You make me sound like I have so much spare time.
Oh, yeah, right. Doesn't sound like you even have time to breathe there. You know what? I just realized that you're the first person that I'm interviewing in 2014, by the way. So I wanted to wish you a happy new year as well.
Oh, thank you. You too.
Thank you. Now, you spent the holidays and New Year back home in Toronto, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, back home in Canada. I'm originally from Canada. I live in Paris now. I've lived throughout the U.S., mainly New York and Washington, but yeah, I spent the holidays in Toronto, and I just kind of lagged around a little bit longer, and I'm heading back to Paris next week. But it's not really a cultural shock going from Paris to Canada, but there are some things that are a bit different that come to note when you're not here for a while, and then suddenly you come back. Funny, especially the weather. I think it's 15 Celsius right now in Paris, and it was 28 below zero Celsius in Toronto and with an ice storm. So, yeah, that's a bit of a shock.
You know, I've been to Toronto a couple of times, love the city, but the weather is just, I don't know if I could ever hack that. But anyway.
That's not even the worst part of the country either, weather-wise. So.
No.
It's a great ad for Tourism Canada I'm doing here, right? Everybody wants to come to Canada now where it's 30 below zero Celsius.
Well, a lot of people do live there. I mean, it is a great, great country. Every time I've been there, I've had a good time. But man,
it's great. It's stable. Banking system's good. I can't really complain. It's just the ice storm. That's about it. That's the only thing going wrong right now.
Well, some of those differences between the U.S. and Canada is definitely, I think, going to provide some interesting fodder for what we're going to discuss here today. And so, why don't we get right into it, Rachel? What I wanted to talk to you about, I know you've been following the Edward Snowden saga from the beginning, and there seems to be two camps in the U.S. and around the world, but before I get into specific aspects of Snowden's actions, because I really want to break it down with you, I want to know where you fall generally, and I want to again mention to everybody that, as we were just discussing, you're a Canadian living in France. Your answers are not colored by some sort of loyalty to the United States, because you're not a U.S. citizen, and I think that's important for people to keep in mind. But getting back to the question, do you fall on the side of folks who think he's a hero, that he did some sort of service to Americans and people around the world by revealing wrongdoing that supposedly nobody knew about? And do you also agree that that crowd seems to think that the threat of terrorism that the NSA surveillance is meant to combat is exaggerated? So do you think that way, or do you generally fall on the side of folks who think that what he did was wrong and that he's a traitor?
Well, there are two issues here, I think, that you're hitting on. The first is the issue of terrorism and whether or not that's legit. There really are terrorists out there, and there are people who want to blow things up. So That really, regardless of what people think of Ed Snowden, that's real. Secondly, the other issue you were touching on is Ed Snowden and, I guess, the legitimacy of what he did and his whole impetus for having done so. I think it's kind of cute that he's, you know, a young man just discovering that spying is a real thing, that espionage and intelligence gathering is a real thing. I think maybe in 20 more years, if he'd have stayed with the job he had and very diligently just worked away, he might have had a different perspective, and not necessarily because he would have been, you know, deeper into the whole cesspool of the intelligence world. I think it's very naive, his worldview, and he you know, comes roaring out of the gate or flies over to Hong Kong, or to, you know, specifically to China and then Russia, which are two countries that are geopolitical competitors of America and the West and the Five Eyes, which is basically the Western Anglo intelligence network, which is pretty much the target of everything that he's been releasing. And Canada and the U.S. do collaborate on intelligence. He's mentioned that repeatedly. I find it really funny, and you were touching on the issue of the differences between Canada and the U.S. at the beginning of your intro there. And what I find really amusing as a Canadian is that nobody in Canada is even reacting to this, because we kind of get this. We understand the importance of intelligence. We don't think transparency is a great thing. It can serve a purpose. For instance, in Canada, members of parliament, which would be equivalent to your congressman in the United States, have to post every single red cent that they spend on lunches, hotels, trips. That goes on a website that people can actually see, so you can see where they ate, what they spent money on. All that's very transparent. But when it comes to national security, things like that, yeah, we don't really want to have that on websites. And there, of course, there are some people who, because of the Internet, because of the way that we have the ability to communicate amongst each other, I guess there are some people who are sympathetic with that cause, but there's no big outcry for transparency. And I really wonder if people in the United States understand that this whole culture of wanting more and more transparency, what it does is it brings out of the woodwork all these hacktivists, these people who perform hacking activities, sideway hacks, who spill data, information onto the Internet, which then gets picked up by companies like Intellius, like, you know, companies where anyone can buy access to private information, like census information. All of this is compiled, because it's out there already, it's public, it's all synthesized, compiled, and as a result, anybody in your country or outside of your country can get information related to identity, relatives, age, cities, previous addresses, property ownership, all that stuff easily, publicly, on the Internet, and it's very transparent. So is that the kind of transparency that America wants? You can't get that in France. You can't find information on people in France that way. You can't find information on people in Canada or the UK that way. But as a result of this push for transparency in the U.S., everybody's data is already public. So I don't know what the big concern is. I mean, if you want transparency, or do you want some level of opacity that protects your privacy? Because I think the strategy that leads to people to believe that they're successfully fighting for something is resulting in the exact opposite of what they want, ultimately.
Well, you know, the other thing I would say is, I think those are really good points. The other thing I would say, though, is that, you know, there's nobody who loves the idea of NSA surveillance. I think the Snowden fans think that they're the only ones fighting for this and they're the only ones who are in the right. Nobody wants that. But on the other hand, you know, like you said, Canadians understand this. They understand why it's necessary. Most people around the world understand why it's necessary. Certainly the governments of countries around the world all know that it's necessary. I mean, I think one of the funniest things that came out right after Snowden's releases was the fact that the European countries were providing data to the NSA. Why? Because they're concerned about terrorism. They don't want to be attacked either. And the U.S. has the best intelligence apparatus to analyze that data and look into this. So I think, like you said, I think if he had had more time to look at this, the 20-plus years that you talked about, he would have had a different perspective. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I think, you know, what we're looking at with respect to Western intelligence and the Five Eyes, which is the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Australia, New Zealand, is a network of intelligence that they all do collaborate, and they all feed into the same system. And the U.S. definitely, among that set, has the best, far none, technological capacity. Canada has excellent, excellent analysts that are probably close to the top, probably with the Brits on that level, just by virtue of the nature of the country and how it's structured. People came here through a vast immigration movement reaching into Russia, the Ukraine, countries like that in the 70s and 80s. Their children were then born in Canada. They've grown up in this culture, and they are now, you know, working for intelligence agencies that are Canadian, but they can very easily slip into the different roles because of their language capacity. And of course, this is an officially bilingual country, so French and English automatically come into play. So just by the makeup of the country, they have the ability, the language ability, and they're very good analysts. So, you know, all these entities, all these intelligence agencies are working together. But it's what people, I think, misunderstand is the nature of the collection. It's data mining. It's not pointed, you know, witch hunts related to one particular person. For instance, PRISM, which is the program that Snowden talked about, which basically is an intelligence collection program, produces what are called data clouds. So these things are just massive amounts of information that are, you know, of course, it's like taking a giant fishing net and trawling, you know, any kind of information base, database, or whatever. And they come up with what's called this data cloud. And, yeah, I mean, it has everything you could possibly want or need or look for, but it's completely useless if the analyst looking at it or the analysts looking at it do not have the skill to understand it and to know how to piece together bits of information. So even if you have all the information in the world about, say, you or me or anybody else out there who's worried about this thing's, you know, danger towards, potential danger towards their personal life or whatever, you have to basically not only have that there and somebody looking at you, but you have to also have that somebody who is looking at you being an analyst who knows how to put all these disparate points together and to structure something that they want to, what, frame you with? Or see, this is the thing, is the pragmatic, on a very logistical level, it makes no sense that somebody would be worried about this program.
Well, let's talk about how it's used, too, and I think that'll help. I mean, what the way that it is used is if somebody is suspected of terrorism or being involved in a terrorist group, they start looking at that person's data, who they've connected with. That's when these clouds that you're talking about come into play, because now you can, through that information, sort of extend the network that this person's part of and look at who might be the next couple of persons of interest. I mean, do I have that right, or have I got that wrong?
Right, but even that, you have to know what you're looking for to go into the data. You don't, because it's a massive amount of information, and it's not just, okay, they don't have silos of data sitting there, like this one's for Steve, this one's for Rachel. Oh,
right.
Rachel, there's something that came to mind. Let's go find the Rachel file. They have to literally know what they're looking for and go and find it and then be able to question what they're seeing and analyze what they're seeing. And it's all there, but would the analysts know how to piece it together? And then even beyond that, people really do not, a lot of people, your listeners probably understand the difference having listened to your show, and I'm sure you've talked about this before ad infinitum, but people often misunderstand the difference between law enforcement and intelligence gathering. When information appears in a court of law, there has to be a warrant issued by a judge that allows for its retrieval. You can't just, you know, a prosecutor can't just go to the FBI or CIA or to the NSA and say, I need some information on this guy because we charged him with something. It doesn't work that way. So there are legislative roadblocks and provisions in place to prevent abuse of the system, and they seem to work quite well, if only because I can't think of a single instance. Maybe I'm wrong and maybe I'm missing something, but is there an instance in which this has been misused or abused to the point where somebody has been able to file a case against the government for misusing intelligence against them? I mean, an American? I can't think of one, and that's the thing, right?
Well, I will tell you that in the period where George W. Bush was doing the warrantless wiretapping, there were a couple of lawsuits brought where it was pretty clear that the federal courts, the appeals courts, said that, that the surveillance was improperly done. But not since 2006, 2007, since they've been going back to using the FISA law, have any suits been successfully brought. And you're exactly right. I did talk to my viewers about this. Way back when this first came out regarding Snowden, I took viewers through how FISA came about, how FISA actually is a strengthening of our privacy and Fourth Amendment protections, because before FISA in the 70s, basically our appeals courts in the United States said anytime the president does or orders surveillance for national security purposes, it's legal. FISA was the first thing that changed that and brought some oversight to it. But your point is exactly right. Outside of the George W. Bush years, there has not been successful suits challenging that, because that's the president's role. The president's role is to keep the country safe from security threats, particularly external security threats. So the idea that this is something wrong, and I see a lot of Snowden supporters saying that what's being done is illegal. It's not illegal. There are FISA warrants for this stuff now.
No, it's not. And I think it's just a misunderstanding of the whole situation. And people get very creative in their concepts of what they're hearing and understanding. And it just doesn't really bear much resemblance to reality, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Well, everybody wants to think that they're important enough to be stalked by the NSA, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's it's cute. Like you said, I think you used the word cute earlier. It's cute that everybody thinks that the NSA really cares about them. But getting back to Snowden for a second, I want to get back to Snowden for a second. Yeah, it does make you feel important.
It's like, oh my gosh, the NSA is looking at my life. And then did you know that people really care about my stuff? And I really don't want the NSA looking at my life. Thank you very much. How arrogant do you have to be to think to even get that idea in your head? You know, it's funny because you and I are more vocal than most people, and if anybody should be worried about this kind of stuff, it's like we have our heads way above water, right? So I'm not even worried. It's like, okay, well, why would they even care? Even though I'm writing about stuff and I'm writing about this and writing about things that are controversial, I still am not arrogant enough to think that the government cares that much about it. You know what I mean?
Exactly. But I think that's the lure of conspiracy theories in general. I think conspiracy theories are primarily geared towards people who feel like they're powerless and they want to feel like they're in on some major secret that nobody knows about. But, boy, we could really go down a rabbit hole talking about that. But, I want to get back to Snowden, though. I've said this many times on my show. It's no revelation to fans who listen. I think he's a traitor. I think a couple of things lead me to believe that in particular. The whole going, like you said, going to Russia and China, of all places, going to Russia and China, and then not using the available mechanisms to report alleged wrongdoing. I talked about this on RT. I think Peter Lavelle and his guest went ballistic when I said that, but he could have used the Inspector General or gone to a member of Congress to report the wrongdoing, and nothing could have happened to him. Nothing could have been done to him. He didn't do that. Instead, really? You're trying to help your country, and you flee to China and Russia with tons of classified documents? I mean, how do you feel about that, honestly?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the Glenn Greenwald keeps saying that there's no mechanism by which somebody working in the intelligence field can actually whistleblow legitimately without getting into a lot of trouble. Or he says there's no actual mechanism for that. But he keeps repeating that. But I'm sorry, he might have had in his mind, you know, some fantasy intent of I'm going to save the U.S. from itself or whatever. But bottom line is just look at the facts. Here's a guy who, A, worked in the intelligence sector, B, was under the law that governs that, in other words, secrecy laws, and C, took off to countries that are known competitors of the United States and released that information from there. He might not have released it to them, at least not wittingly, but they have ways of getting these things without you wittingly handing it over. Ask the French. Anybody who's been to the conference in Le Bourget, where it's a big air show every year, anybody who knows anything worthwhile will tell you that you do not leave important technical information or computers sitting in your hotel room because the French have a way of getting it. So, I mean, this is people are saying, well, he didn't actually give it to them. No, but they're very aggressive spying nations, and they have technical capabilities that Edward Snowden very likely doesn't understand. So just because he thinks he didn't hand it over, you know, it's just naive. It's this is a common thread that infuses throughout this whole case. It's just this real naivety about how things work, how the world works, how intelligence agencies and services work. You know, and he was an IT guy, and granted, I would have to assume he was an intelligent one. By all accounts, he wasn't stupid. He's an intelligent guy. But you can be intelligent and still not understand these things, right? So,
exactly.
Yeah. If it walks like a duck, you know?
Yeah.
And Russia and China, I can't get over that. I mean, you know, if you're protesting something about a country, why go to a country that's worse to flee to? I mean, of all the countries in the world, he couldn't have found a better place. I mean, you look at human rights in Russia. Russian journalists who criticize the Russian government, they end up dead. It's dissidents who flee the country, who annoy the Kremlin too much, they also end up dead, some horribly, like Litvinenko. Polonium poisoning, which takes weeks of painful suffering before you die. This is where he flees.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, well, he did because he knows there are two things at play here. There's the issue of traitors and how Putin feels about traitors, and he's made it very clear how he feels about traitors. He has absolutely no use for them. But on a second track, we have the whole issue of the old Cold War rivalry, right, which never really dies. I mean, it might die down, but there's always this undercurrent of this Cold War rivalry, right? So on one hand, this guy lands in Putin's lap, and he's thinking, he disgusts me. On a human level, I'm sure he's disgusted by him. But looking at the second track and the old Cold War rivalries, this is a useful tool. This guy's willing to fall into my lap with a ton of intelligence and sit at the airport to, okay, fine, like, I'm not going to stop him. In other words, Putin would instrumentalize him, which he has done, to use him. He's a bargaining chip. But now I don't think they have any use for him anymore. And I wouldn't be surprised to hear that, you know, suddenly upon arrival after the Sochi Olympic Games, the U.S. team had one more member landing in the USA. You know what I mean? And he happened to be in with the bags or something. I mean, I don't think Putin really has much use for him anymore. I think he initially did. But what we're seeing now is, especially in the wake of everything that's happening with Syria, Putin was largely seen as having bailed out, you know, the U.S. for having taken that whole situation under control into his sphere, which should have been done months ago anyway, I think, because why should the U.S. have to deal with that situation when it is in the Russian sphere, when it is a situation involving terrorists and terror activity in Syria? And they, you know, it's close enough to Sochi in the games that really it is Russia's problem. It should have been Russia's problem to deal with. And he should have been in a position to remove the weapons and you know, make sure that there weren't going to be any biological weapons flying around. But all that to say that, you know, there are so many complex geopolitical issues at play here. And Edward Snowden is just, he said what everything it is he's going to say. He served the purpose as far as Putin is concerned. And I don't think Putin necessarily wants to create any great animosity towards the U.S., given the fact that I think the next phase of kind of geopolitical cooperation is going to be most likely, if I was to guess, the U.S. and Russia fighting Islamic terrorism in counter-terrorist joint activities. That's my guess. And
well, it's funny
they've
that
already
you mentioned
been training
that.
Together. Yeah, they've already been training together. In El Dorado.
And you know, now Putin has these issues. I mean, Russia, like every other country, faces the issue of terrorism, right? But that hasn't been as big of an issue for Russia since the Snowden saga started until this past week. So just like you were saying that Russia has no use for him anymore, now he's even become a liability, right? With the two terrorist bombings in Volgograd by that group saying they intend to disrupt the Sochi Olympics. I mean, now Putin's in an awkward position. He's harboring a guy who claims that the United States intelligence services are going too far in their fight against terrorism while he's struggling to have Russia deal with its own terrorism issue. I mean, that I don't know why nobody else is talking about that besides me right now, but that is a pretty ugly and hypocritical place for Putin to be in right now, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think he's already made it so that Snowden is kind of fading into the background, at least as far as Putin is concerned. He's not even talking about the guy. And I think ultimately we'll see something occurring around Snowden, and I think it'll just fade completely. And I think Putin wants him out of the country, if I was to guess. And again, actually just this week and last week I wrote about the Sochi Olympics and how the next phase in counterterrorism efforts is likely going to be a joint effort between the U.S. and Russia. They've been training together. That this is that Islamic terrorism in Russia has always been an issue, and we forget about that because people don't really understand the nature of it. And in fact, China is also being affected right now too. There have been some hits on the border with Russia, the Chinese
That's right.
border with Russia, and the Uyghur Islamists, and they're having a lot of issues with them as well. So it's a global issue, and going back to what you're saying at the very beginning of all this, is Islamic terrorism being played up? Is it real? I mean, yeah, I mean, it's real for everyone. And I think we most likely will see cooperation both around the Olympics with Sochi as a pretext for coming together to deal with this on an international level, and thereafter. I don't know exactly what form thereafter, but I think that's the next. I'd watch for that. I think that's going to be an interesting development.
I think you're right, and that's the last word because we've gone way over time, but she's a force to be reckoned with, successful business person, and an internationally well-known and syndicated journalist. Rachel, thank you again for spending time with me today.
Thanks, Steve.
We don't get fooled again.
What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, BADLER.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. And now it's time for our weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. Winning the Hall of Fame this week is Patrick Foye, Executive Director of the Port Authority of Newark, New York and New Jersey. As reported by Talking Points memo, Port Authority Executive Director Pat Foye wrote an impassioned email to the General Manager of the George Washington Bridge on September 13th, arguing that the lane closures that spiraled into a major scandal this week were illegal. Foye's email, addressed to Robert Durando and other Port Authority officials, fumed that he was not included in the decision, which he said was damaging the public safety and the economy. The beginning of the letter read, "After reading last night's media pendings, I made inquiries and received calls on this matter, which is very troubling. Here's what I learned. Reversing over 25 years of Port Authority George Washington Bridge operations, the 3 lanes in Fort Lee eastbound to the bridge were reduced to 1 lane on Monday of this week without notifying Fort Lee, the commuting public we serve, the executive director, or the media. A decision of this magnitude should be made only after careful deliberation and upon sign-off by the executive director. Reports are that Fort Lee has experienced severe traffic delays engulfing the entire Fort Lee area since Monday. I am appalled by the lack of process, failure to inform our customers and Fort Lee, and most of all by the dangers created to the public interest. So I am reversing this decision, now effective as soon as tunnels, bridges, and terminals and the Port Authority Police Department tell me it is safe to do so today." He went on to say, This hasty and ill-advised decision has resulted in delays to emergency vehicles. I pray that no life has been lost or a trip of a hospital or hospice-bound patient delayed, he wrote. He added, I believe this hasty and ill-advised decision violates federal law and the laws of both states. To be clear, Foyer declared, I will get to the bottom of this abusive decision which violates everything this agency stands for. I intend to learn how the Port Authority process was wrongly subverted and the public interest damaged, to say nothing of the credibility of this agency. Now, a few minutes after that memo was sent out to various Port Authority officials, one of them, Robert Durando, responded, quote, we have restored the three toll lanes to Fort Lee. That's all it took, this letter from Mr. Foyer. This is one of the many interesting subplots in the scandal involving the administration of Governor Chris Christie. One wonders what would have happened if Mr. Foyer, who was appointed in 2011 by New York's Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo to head the Port Authority, one wonders what would have happened if he had not taken the initiative to open those lanes back up when he did. He did this Friday morning. The lanes, two of those three lanes, were closed Monday morning. Another way of looking at this is, it took the competent appointee of a Democratic governor to undo the acts of corrupt appointees from a Republican governor. Congratulations to Patrick Foyer for winning our Hall of Fame this week for making great sense. Now we have our Hall of Shame this week for those politicians and prominent individuals who made shameful nonsense.
All aboard!
In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have Diane Edmondson, chair of the Denton County Republican Party in Texas. Some of you will recall the epic filibuster in Texas by Texas State Senator Wendy Davis to protect the abortion rights of the women of Texas. In the wake of that filibuster, Senator Davis, who represents Fort Worth and is a Democrat, has launched a campaign for governor of Texas. Anti-choice Republicans in Texas are concerned by Senator Davis's candidacy. One in particular, Diane Edmondson, chair of the Denton County Republican Party, made a really disgusting reference to Senator Davis in a newsletter that she recently sent out. As reported in the Burnt Orange report, Ms. Edmondson said she was concerned over, quote, the superwomen ticket of abortion Barbie with Hispanic Senator Leticia Vanderput as her running mate. It goes on to say, quote, we have our work cut out for us to dispute the Dems' false accusations of a Republican war on women. I love the irony there. Texas Republicans are so concerned about the women's vote, they slur two women with the nasty, pejorative abortion Barbie and that, quote, Hispanic Senator Leticia Vanderput. What are these people thinking? I mean, in fact, Texas Democratic State Representative Pancho Nevarez, who represents Eagle Pass, said on Twitter, quote, I would say to those Hispanics already in the GOP fold, or those being wooed, this is what they think of you. And Representative Nevarez was referring to the Republican Party in Texas. Great job, Chairperson Edmondson. Slurring women, slurring those who are pro-choice, along with an insulting reference to a woman being Hispanic. I'm thinking, you know what? Politics is not for you, ma'am. Might I suggest bowling? Diane Edmondson, chair of the Denton County Republican Party in Texas, is third place this week in our Hall of Shame for worst nonsense of the week. In second place for even worse nonsense this week, we have the presiding judges in the case of a 27-year-old alleged rapist in Lund District Court in Sweden. According to The Local, which is the name of an online English-language media organization in Sweden, the presiding judges in the case of this 27-year-old accused of rape, freed the suspect and dismissed the charges because the suspect claims that the victims' screams of protest were part of a violent sex game. Quote, I expressed very clearly that I didn't want to, so there was no way he could misunderstand me, the victim told investigators. In its ruling, the Lund District Court said that both versions of what happened were credible and, for the most part, in agreement. Among other things, the court said it was clear that the 27-year-old had used violence to force the woman to have sex with him, and that the woman's muted protests could be attributed to fear that the man might even become more aggressive. However, the court tossed out the rape charge, ruling it had not been proven that the 27-year-old had acted with intent to act against the woman's wishes. The verdict, get this, cited the suspect's explanation that he thought the woman's protests were part of a violent sex game, despite the lack of an explicit agreement or consent between the two parties about dominant sexual role play. I recognized the way she said no as part of the sex. I recognized it from other girls, the man said during questioning. I mean, you understand what the judges said. No discussion of S&M or sexual violent role play had been discussed. He just assumed that that was what was going on. And it's even more disgusting when you consider what the guy said. I recognize the way she said no as part of the sex. I recognize it from other girls. That means he's done this before. When viewed in that light, his defense is basically that the woman screamed like other women that he has raped before. Now, this ruling is really shameful. I did some research. This ruling occurs in the backdrop of Sweden having one of the highest incidents of rape in Europe. Why not? I mean, apparently rapists get away with it. All the rapists in Europe probably are moving there. Those judges presiding in the Lund District Court are runners-up this week in our Hall of Shame for infamous nonsense. But the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to Virginia State Legislator Republican Thomas Garrett. Now, as many of you know, the Republican candidate for governor in 2013 who lost to Terry McAuliffe was Lieutenant Governor Ken Cuccinelli. Mr. Cuccinelli was notorious for having as part of his platform the desire to pass a law that would have outlawed all oral and anal sex in the state of Virginia, no matter age or consent. With Cuccinelli losing that Virginia governor's race this past November, most of us thought that the insanity of attempting to control what consenting people did in the bedroom with each other was over, right? Safe to assume that. Turns out, it's not. Virginia State Legislator Thomas Garrett, who says he considers himself a Cuccinelli acolyte, has put forth a bill that would make it a felony for two teenagers ages 15 to 17 to engage in oral or anal sex with each other. Now look, before we get into how ridiculous this is, in one sense, I get some of the thinking behind why someone would create a bill like this. I've got a teenage daughter. No one wants to think of their teenage kids having oral or anal sex or any other kind of sex. We would all like for that not to happen. Okay, I get that part. But the answer is not to convict young kids of sex felonies that they'll have on their records for the rest of their lives. What kind of person wants to do that to kids? That's an immature and poorly thought out reaction to the idea of teens having sex with each other. I mean, how silly is that? Think about that for a moment, folks. You want to protect teens from having sex too early, so you convict them of a felony that will follow them the rest of their whole lives? I mean, someone grew up and forgot to develop some critical thinking skills here, Mr. Garrett. So Thomas Garrett, the Republican state legislator from Virginia, wins the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, January 19th. And Monday, January 20th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio 1050 AM in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me and the show on Twitter at Stephen Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.